Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Daniel Giacopelli.
On this week's show, we'll ask, how do you update a classic with creative minds Stephen Bailey and Roger Mavity? They'll be talking us through their newly revised edition of their business and lifestyle bible, Life's a Pitch.
We'll also be discussing this year's Emmy Awards, with the ceremony set to take place tonight. Critic Alice Vincent will be joining us for a whistle-stop binge of telly's top talent and discussing why TV is increasingly thinking outside the box.
And we'll also be looking at the science of food with broadcaster and science writer Marty Jobson. His new book looks at the molecular magic going on in our meals.
All that, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be making a dog's dinner of the news look ahead. And we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, Andrew, here we are. Another week. It's not Tom Edwards. It's you this week.
I've had a little bit of a sojourn, as you might say, from the old world of the weekly, because we were doing the newspaper throughout August.
Indeed.
And I kind of looked up from my laptop for like 4, 5, 6 weeks solid.
Yeah.
So I said, do you know what, guys? I'm not going to be on the weekly. But I've missed it.
We're back to the normal production schedule of insanity and not hyper-insanity.
It's not too bad. We've got a whole 4 weeks to do an issue of the magazine, which feels slightly extraordinary. And I'm going to be on tour a little bit, doing a few Monocle things over the coming weeks. But otherwise, all good. And you, Danny?
Everything's good. Everything's great. People could check out The Entrepreneurs this week. Just throw a little tidbit, a little promo of that. I interviewed the founder of the mattress startup Simba. Do you guys know the mattress mania that's going on in the startup world?
Yeah, we've done that in print already, Danny. I know, but I'm a real kind of unsure person about this mattress revolution, because it's all about these kind of like foam-filled, very smelly, rather polluting mattresses, I think.
Really?
I think so, because I like an old mattress. They're comfortable, and I don't want to lie in a big old piece of extruded sponge.
You heard it here first. Speaking of a big old piece of extruding sponge, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
I set that one up nicely. Henry, oh Henry, yeah. Love the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, love the way he takes his hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all right. Welcome to the show, Henry. You do get some very good introductions on the show, and even Danny's being mean these days. Now tell us, what have you got in the news look ahead?
On the 23rd of September, there's a general election taking place in New Zealand. I know what you're thinking, but this year, it is genuinely exciting. So to give you a little bit of context, the last election was in 2014. For the fourth election in a row, the Labour Party, the traditional main opposition party to the National Conservative Party, lost ground for the fourth election in a row. But now they have a young upstart at their head. She's called Jacinda Ardern. She's 37 years old, so 2 years younger than Emmanuel Macron. She took over on August the 1st, and in just over a month, she boosted the party's polling by an astonishing 19 points. So this is shaping up to be a genuine matchup for the first time in a long time in that part of the Antipodes. I'm not sure if you guys know anything about Jacinda. They call the phenomenon of her popularity Jacinda Mania. Have you seen her, Danny?
I have neither heard of her. Nor
you're telling
know
me
anything
that you're
about
not
this.
Keeping abreast of New Zealand politics.
I have
on
to say,
basis.
I have been watching a lot of New Zealand cinema lately.
Have you?
That won't help you.
Go on.
Search for The Wilder People. Fantastic film.
Wilder People.
Boy.
Yes, an amazing film.
Fantastic film.
What's it about?
It's about a year old, but it's fine.
Okay.
It's about a boy who should have gone into care, and he goes on the run.
It's rather large.
And it's a comedy.
Okay.
But I know nothing about New Zealand politics.
I mean,
this does sound fascinating.
That's totally irrelevant, but anyway.
If you had read the newspaper, we did two pages on her in the newspaper. We went on the campaign trail with her. So you can still get those newspapers by going to monocle.com.
Now, Andrew's out-scooping both of us
today.
I know.
I'm ahead of you. This has been my August.
I'm just teeing you up, Andrew.
The interesting thing is, I think that how many countries, you know, it's like somebody launches a successful product, everyone tries to copy it. If you're a successful band, everyone tries to copy your sound. Everyone's now looking for their Justin Trudeau moment or their Macron moment. And I think she's fascinating. But what's interesting is you can get quite a lot of energy behind you just by trying to be that thing that everyone else has already got. So I'm sure she's a great politician. But just the number of times that she's been described as, you know, the Kiwi Macron, it's obvious that we, even in our politics, we look for very simple branding taglines to attach to things, and then we can kind of begin to compute what they mean for us.
I mean, I agree with you, but to what extent do you think these people are brought to attention because of pre-existing models? And to what extent do you think they're actually meeting perhaps the needs of global conditions, which, you know, there are patterns of across the world?
God, here he are some highfalutin questions, isn't he? I would say that just as they have their kind of like their Macron moment now, the Kiwis are stuck in the same situation as the UK is, as Australia is, as France is, where you have traditional left and right parties. One opts for a slightly younger voice. And then in the middle, you have this small populist rump. You know, New Zealand is the same. New Zealand is, you know, a country that everyone thinks of as, you know, all fresh water and avocados and sheep. But in fact, it has in the middle a very anti-immigration populist party who will likely hold the sway of power yet again. They've done it again and again. And it's just interesting how actually all these global politics in developed countries, everyone's kind of ended up in the same kind of situation. So, you know, you have a Farage, you have a Marine Le Pen, you have a Donald Trump. Maybe they tussle to the top or not. You have, you know, often a couple of, you know, legacy parties who are struggling to reconnect. And the option seems to be to get out of jail is to choose somebody who's super young, who often doesn't have a huge track record of politics. She has very little experience, but it's her youth that is appealing, and it's her ability to start with a clean slate.
Danny, anything to add?
I'm just looking forward to the next item.
I'll move on then. So on the 21st of September, the EU-Canada free trade deal, popularly known as CETA, is to take effect. Now, you will remember that last year they kind of hashed out the details of this. There were a lot of political wrangling. The balloons nearly derailed it, as is their wont. The Belgian faction didn't think the deal went far enough in terms of protecting local and environmental standards. Anyway, it was
so
almost...
one of the people who runs this company is a Belgian. I think you should be very wary of kind of stepping out of this studio afterwards.
But anyway, Wallonia, that's what it's called. Now, just before it takes effect, Poland is threatening to block a part of the trade deal because it's not happy with its dispute settlement mechanism. Why is Danny laughing?
I'm laughing because couldn't have picked a more boring topic for what's happening next week.
This is important, Danny. This is going to affect
where are
the
funny events? Where's like the Santa Claus race in Lapland?
Andrew wasn't here last year, but I got told off for doing for doing too many funny events.
No.
So the pendulum has swung the other way.
We all know it's interesting because, I guess, here in the UK, for example, we're watching these events unfold and we're wondering, is this the kind of deal that we will eventually get? And we were interested to see how it play out. Now, it's interesting that if the Poles can poke a stick in the spokes, as it were, at the last minute and scupper this yet again, it shows you how complex all of these trade negotiations are. I think it makes you wary sitting here in Brexit-threatened Britain that all these kind of promised trade deals are going to be much more complicated to get, especially when you've managed to kind of annoy most of the other members of the EU during the period of negotiation for leaving the EU.
This, I think, is fun and interesting. On the 22nd of September, it's the annual meeting of, you will have heard of the G8 group of nations. It's the G77 group of nations. Their foreign ministers are coming to New York for their annual meeting. It is a loose coalition of developing nations, mainly represented in the global south, which is meant to, like the G8, promote its members' collective economic interests in the UN. And the policies are kind of interesting. They've been, throughout history, very unanimously adopting a stance against apartheid, supporting global disarmament, but they've also been very opposed to pro-environmental initiatives, which they consider secondary to boosting their own economic standing. I was just interested to learn about that massive group existing and kind of operating parallel to the other larger groups of more wealthy nations that we hear about a lot.
My sympathy is with the photographer who's going to get them all on stage and in the right pecking order.
Yeah, it's like your school photo, isn't it? Some of them will have to kneel at the front. You're interested in international relations, Danny. You must have some views on this, surely.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just wondering why it's 77 and not 7. I mean, if there's a G77, there's a G8.
There's a 24, too.
That means we're missing how many countries? I mean, there's how many countries in the world?
Yeah, some people slip through the gap.
200?
So China...
160-ish, I think.
China participates in the G77, but it doesn't consider itself a member. So all the documents, all the statements that they make are signed the G77 and China, which I think a few other groups do as well sometimes with other...
Yeah, there's the G... There's the G5. X something plus something.
Yeah,
you know, they
yeah,
have all
yeah.
the kinds of acronyms.
Yeah. So it's just another band kind of featuring another contributing artist on the side.
And you're both interested in international relations, aren't you?
I have a master's in war studies.
That's what
I'm
referring
to.
Oh, I thought you meant you were talking about your girlfriends. But anyway, there you go. Got them both. Well, thank you very much for coming here to talk about your international relations and your G77s and your Polish clauses. It's been a treat.
When the cultural commentator Stephen Bailey and creative industry luminary Roger Maverty published their professional Bible, Life's a Pitch, around a decade ago, the world of business sat up and listened.
But that world is a very different place today compared to 2007, and both Bailey and Maverty know that the creative industries wait for no man or woman. So the duo are this month releasing an updated volume of Life's a Pitch, which looks at the influence of everything from digital media to the rise of Donald Trump. And they join us now to talk about it. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly.
Well, hello.
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 Well, Stephen, perhaps we'll start with you. The first question I wanted to ask is whether you thought the pitch was an endangered species. Again and again, we come across people who seem to think that an algorithm is enough to solve every problem these days. Are you concerned about the pitch and its future existence?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, I'm no Luddite, but I'm deeply sceptical about the digital revolution. I think most of the interesting things in the world are analog, not virtual. And our book, Life's a Pitch, it's the ultimate analog book because it just presents the proposition that appearances matter. Human relationships are immensely important. And if you accept that appearances matter and human relationships are very important, you want to work really hard on making them work for you.
And one of the industries that you know well, advertising, it does seem there that the pitch still does exist in some hearty format. Maybe some of the lunches have disappeared, but certainly the pitch is still the thing.
Well, for me, I mean, you must speak to Roger about advertising, but you know, I mess around in the world of brands and so on. We all know that all the big brands are disappearing and being revised, and we know that whole world is changing very rapidly, and possibly for the better, possibly for the worse. We don't need it too early to stay. But you're never going to take away the fact that life is, as the book says, is a pitch. We're always trying, every single encounter we make, whether it's a professional one or a personal one, you're actually pitching something to someone. You're pitching yourself, you're pitching a proposition, whether it's love or it's business or whatever. And once you accept that, learn about it, understand it, try to do it better, enjoy it.
I mean, Roger, this idea sort of jives with the modern era of social media and digital natives in which everybody is trying to project an image upon the world. Everybody has a personal brand. Are we becoming more pitch conscious now?
Well, I think people talk about pitches as if it's a man standing in a room staring at 20 people with a PowerPoint. And indeed, sometimes it still is, and you have to know how to do that well too. But actually, everything that happens around you all the time is a pitch. And you talk about algorithms, but the important things that people are thinking about now aren't any different from what they were thinking about 50 years ago. You want to find a partner for life. You want to borrow the money to start your business. You aren't going to get either of those things with an algorithm. You have to be there in person and you have to sell your case.
One of the things you touch on quite a lot, Roger, is this notion of unusual thinking and how you break out of the regimented world of, you know, sitting in an office, sitting at your computer screen. And I guess that's the bit that you sometimes fear is a little bit lost in the days now of modern work, where people are rather stuck in front of a laptop the whole day, and they've often failed to even look up from their laptop. Is that unusual thinking for either of you something that we're kind of losing a little bit?
Well, yeah, we all spend too much time in front of screens, but an email is a pitch. An email is a modern form of letter, and writing a letter is an advertisement for yourself. I mean, first of all, I'd advocate putting great care into writing emails. You should punctuate them properly. You should write them with the care and attention which you would. You know, you're creating an ad with an email, you know, do it properly. Furthermore, and I said, I don't want to sound like a Luddite, and I'm really not, but no one's going to bed tonight dreaming about algorithms. But people are going to bed tonight dreaming about...
No, we're heartily with you, believe us.
about fantasies, dreams, desires. Right now, for absolutely certain, we have a chapter in the book on how to write a letter, which is one of my favourite chapters. You know, if you want to draw attention to yourself, don't send... You know, any fool can send an email to 5 million people in the next few minutes if you wanted. However, if you really want to draw attention to yourself or make a pitch, I'd suggest buying some really good stationery, a proper pen, and writing a letter.
Roger, I mean, in the book, you guys tell the story of tons of extraordinary salespeople from all walks of life. Who's the best salesperson you guys have ever met?
The best salesperson in recent times is Donald Trump, because he has taken a completely unsaleable proposition, namely himself, and pitched it into the most powerful job in the world at a time when the world feels a very fragile place. So it's not a successful pitch I'm particularly pleased about. I'm finding it hard to sleep nights at the moment. But the fact of it is, he did do a fantastic job and completely outmaneuvered Hillary Clinton, who's a very seasoned Washington operator.
Is the art of the deal kind of nudging you guys on the Amazon bestseller list? The ranking?
I've never read The Art of the Deal, and I plan enthusiastically not to.
But, Stephen, when you look at the world of politics then, do you feel that... Is the Donald Trump thing this notion of populism which seems to kind of run away with almost no feeling of the pitch that's going on?
I don't know. One thing I'm very, very struck by, and there's been a lot of comment on it in the British press recently, is how lackluster and mediocre our own politicians are. I mean, no one, you know, I mean, clearly there's very little disagreement that Trump is an appalling, ignorant vulgarian and not competent to occupy the position he does. But, as Roger says, there's a lot to be learned from what he's done. And it's interesting, we have a little spoof interview with Donald Trump at the back of the book. And, you know, this is quite something extraordinary. The man is inarticulate, he's not in possession of any original ideas, apparently has no moral compass, as we say, but he seems to know where he's going and has done it extremely well. I only wish, and he acts with great conviction too, which I always think is immensely important in any form of pitch. I only wish some of our politicians had higher purposes than Trump, but similar persuasive powers.
When you look at our own politicians, and some of the things you talk about, those first impressions, now status is incredibly important, but sometimes status, I guess, can play against you. So Theresa May ran through the summer in a way that seemed a very elevated status, very high concept of what she stood for and a belief that she wouldn't get it wrong. But then she kind of totally came a cropper because the status was too high. So in this pitch to us, do you have to kind of be aware that maybe your status is playing against you at times?
I'm struggling a bit with Theresa May's status. she comes across to me as somebody that we were all thrilled when she got the job, because she had three fantastic qualifications. She wasn't Angela Leadsom, she wasn't Michael Gove, and she wasn't even Boris Johnson. But everything that she's done then, whatever it's got, it certainly doesn't strike me as having status. It strikes me as having stubbornness, lack of imagination, inflexibility, unwillingness to listen to other people, unwillingness to trust other people. So I don't see her as high status, whatever that means at all. I see her as somebody who's actually overpromoted and out of her depth.
It saddens me to say this, but I'm afraid our Prime Minister is evidence of that rule about first impressions. I mean, first impressions do count. You can tell from appearances. Oscar Wilde said only shallow people don't tell from appearances. Appearances count. I'm afraid Mrs. May's body language is utterly defensive and apologetic. I mean, we're not even talking about the particulars now, Brexit or whatever. You can actually tell just by her whole demeanour, vocabulary, everything about her. She lacks conviction and courage.
I want to talk about business books in general. I mean, I produce a business show here. I get sent an ungodly amount, you know, enough to make a library. Most of them are crap. I mean, most business books are not good. How do you write a good one, you know, that cuts through all the clutter, the noise of just the same old mess?
I've only read two good business books in my life. One is Life's a Pitch. The other one is The Prince by Machiavelli, which is now in its, whereas ours is in its 10th year. That must be in about its 400th. But it is a work of genius in understanding how power operates. And that is really what business is about. It's about running stuff. And Machiavelli's book was How You Should Run a State. But a principality in Renaissance Italy is not that much different structurally from a big business in Western Europe or America today. And it is an incredibly insightful book.
Yeah. Well, we describe Machiavelli as the first management consultant, which of course he was, and his advice is there to be summarized absolutely perfectly, a little bit of a si guarda al fine, always beware of the end result. And just that's the essential Machiavellian principle. Just make you absolutely certain you know what you're looking for and do whatever you can to get it. But for me, you're absolutely right about business books. It fascinates me that business is an enthralling subject. Most books are so deadly dull. But for me, I'm professionally interested in design. And I sort of vaguely moved on from fretting about the design of radios and washing machines and to thinking about actually the biggest design project of all is how to design yourself, which is, for me, is what our book's about. It's about how to create a winning persona and a winning demeanour and a winning appearance. I mean, it's a whole package. It's a branding, you know. As John Hegarty, who sweetly wrote Britain's Greatest Ad Man, who sweetly wrote a nice endorsement on the cover of the book, he said all of life is a matter of branding. And of course it is.
There's a gentleman that unites the two of you through this book. We should explain to people that the book is kind of two books in one. You both get your own territory to kind of tell your story. But there is a uniting force, which is Sir Terence Conran, who you both been connected with professionally. And Roger, I think in the introduction
I'm disconnected professionally.
But both of you kind of seem to mention you've been hired and fired as many times by Sir Terence Conran. Now, in the world of pitching to him, obviously he's run with some of your ideas and turned his nose up at others. How is that pitch process with somebody who you admire and sometimes it just doesn't go very well?
Well, I admire and like Terence enormously, and he's a hugely talented visionary. But as even he might admit, he's not that easy a bedfellow. So life with Terence usually has moments of closeness followed by a fatwa. I'm not sure that there are any rules for pitching to Terence. Actually, there is a rule, which is that you mustn't be frightened of him. You've got to be yourself. Because big, powerful people, and he's all of that, can be very intimidating, and there's a tendency to tell them what you think they want to hear rather than what they need to know. And that doesn't get very far, because smart people can see through that at 20 paces. So with Terence, you have to stand up to him and be honest. That will cause a few sparks, but it will make some progress too.
I've got a wonderful anecdote which you might enjoy to illustrate the cussedness and genius of Terence Conran. 30 or so years ago, when I was planning what became the Design Museum, I was sitting in my office in Terence's building late one night writing something, and Terence bimbled in and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just writing a little piece for the Sunday Times." And he said, "Why don't you show me what it is? What are you writing?" And I showed it to him, and he said, "You cannot write this." And I said, "Come on, Terence, come off it. I've got my mind of my own." He said, "You cannot write this. I will not have you write this." So I said, "For God's sake," just tore the piece of paper out of the machine, threw it away. And then Terence said, "Why do I employ you if you don't know your own mind?" So he recognises quality, that's what it is.
Well, give us one or two takeaways for people. You talked about fear there, Roger. It's interesting, you talk about in the book, you have to overcome that fear. You have to realise you are kind of putting on an act. You can't not rehearse. You've got to kind of get in the moment. Is that the essential success of a good pitch, is that you just walk in there confident that you know every single thing that's going to be thrown at you?
You'd be surprised how much fan mail we get from people who've read Life's a Pitch, because I think they're nervous about pitching and they know it's important. And the book's given them help. And when you talk to those kind of people, what's clear is that most people are innately very unconfident about selling their case. So there's more to it than simply whipping yourself up into a state of self-belief. But if there's one single ingredient which is important, it probably is that. And I think key to that is having the courage to say what you think. If you tell people what they want to hear, you'll always come second.
And Stephen, for you, the essential ingredient of an amazing pitch?
Well, yeah, what I should perhaps explain to the listeners is that it's not quite as clear-cut as this. Roger essentially is giving, based on his huge experience in advertising, is giving a practical guide to pitching, which would be incredibly useful, has proven to be incredibly useful to people actually involved in business and, you know, any form of presentational activity. My part of the book tends to be sort of more about cultural history, more discursive, more about ideas. But for me, perhaps the single piece of advice I distill from it is, I think we're all three different people. One, we're the person we think we are, and secondly, we're the person other people think we are, and thirdly, we're the person which we worry that other people think we might be. And the clever thing is actually to bring all those three different strands into one connected entity. You know, be what you are. Be exactly as you seem. Appearances matter. Style matters. Articulacy matters. And just actually caring about things.
Lovely.
It's very important.
The revised edition of Life's a Pitch is available via Penguin Random House on the 21st of September. Thanks, Stephen and Roger, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew, are you in the mood for a tune?
Oh, please sing to me, Danny.
Well, let's hear a track from St. Vincent, or Annie Clark. This is her song, Los Angeles. And that was St. Vincent with Los Angeles from her upcoming album, Mass Education, arriving in October. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Up next, we talk TV.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Tune in to The Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Tonight, LA's glamorously named Microsoft Theatre, I'm not sure that's so glamorous, is it? Will be hosting the 69th Annual Emmy Awards. The show that highlights the best in TV talent has played second fiddle to the Oscars for much of its existence, but there's something going on in TV right now, with the rise of streaming services such as Netflix, lending productions ever more cinematic budgets, and delivering arguably more interesting results.
In a moment, we'll speak with Alice Vinson, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, about why the small screen is generating such big hits. But first, here's a taste of some of them.
In the beginning, this place was pure creation. I have designed every inch of it. Every blade of grass. It's not a theme park, but an entire world. In here, we create life itself. Out of chaos.
My name is Alfred. I had another name.
Ladies, I have to let you go. It's the law now.
They needed to do it this way. All the bank accounts and the jobs all at the same time. You imagine the airports otherwise?
Run, run, run!
No, please, don't take her!
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
Chuck bamboozled me again.
It's your word against mine.
Don't think I'll ever forget what happened here today. You will pay.
You need me. I'm not gonna let you fight this on your own.
No, I will fix this myself, me, Jimmy McGill.
Are you free for breakfast tomorrow?
Who's got your back, huh? Me, that's who.
I'll keep that in mind.
So, what's our next move?
Westworld, The Handmaid's Tale, and Better Call Saul there. Well, as we said, we're now joined by Alice Vinson. Alice, when we look at what's up for nomination, there is an incredible rise in the quality of TV down to the likes of Netflix. You've been covering this sector for some time. How do you view what's happening in the market at the moment for TV?
I just find it fascinating. I mean, this has always been a shift the minute Netflix came onto the arena, because it wasn't relying on advertising. Instead, you pay your $6-7 a month, and that's where the money comes from. And that means 4 years ago, Netflix wasn't even a contender on the Emmys. 4 years ago was the first time they got nominations. They got 14, and House of Cards famously walked away with a prize. And now they've got 91 this year. So that's 4 years, and that is a ridiculous increase. And what is happening is really, frankly, it boils down to the cash. Netflix can afford to throw an awful lot of money at these dramas. They've always been very bold about their intention to rival HBO, who's the US network, which has the very big juggernaut, shiny, gorgeous shows. And here they are, dominating drama.
Just before we move on maybe to the actual shows themselves, we were doing a thing about film the other day and saying that actually it's been a bit of a lackluster summer for the box office. Now, up until now, TV and film didn't seem to be eating each other's markets. Do you think that potentially, you know, the notion of it's just entertainment now and how we park ourselves for our time, that actually cinema may have a tougher time going forward when these shows are so successful and seem to be less hit and miss maybe than movies, because they, you know, they analyse every frame to make sure they understand what people are looking for. There's just so much good TV. Do you think that it will kind of damage film in the end?
I think what is at risk of damaging film is not what the consumer wants, but rather the shift of talent. So in the last few years, we've seen an awful lot of directors who wouldn't previously touch TV with a barge pole move over into making this very high quality TV. And that's where the talent has gone. That we've also seen a lot of big screen A-listers go and act in these vehicles as well. And of course, if people have their Netflix subscription, they maybe don't think about that money going out every month, and they're sitting and they're binging on a series, they're going to be less inclined to go and spend $20 on a ticket to the cinema.
So now the Emmys, which is today, it's said to be, it's been pretty predictable over the past few years, but this year it's different. Why is it different this year?
I think because previously Hulu, which is a US streaming network that isn't available internationally like Amazon and Netflix, has really finally, after years of being left in the dirt, got behind making quality drama and put out Handmaid's Tale, which we heard there. And so they've finally got some nominations this year, several years behind everybody else.
Such a good show.
It's a great show. Yeah.
And a lot of the nominees this year also, they're completely new to the scene as well.
They are.
It's their first season, like Westworld, we just heard there.
Exactly. Now, Westworld is made by HBO, so that is a kind of a cable show. And I imagine the execs at HBO were really glad that got an Emmy nomination, because after the juggernaut of Game of Thrones, they were hoping that Westworld would be the new one to take its place. And they would have miffed, I think, if it hadn't got an Emmy nomination.
Right, so should we go through the shows?
Yeah, let's go through a few of them. And
I've seen a lot of them.
Okay, Danny, you have more free time than me, mate.
Fine.
That's a lie, that's a lie.
Should we start with The Handmaid's Tale?
Yes,
which
absolutely.
I absolutely loved. The Handmaid's Tale, rather. So that's on Hulu. Will they win? I hope they win.
I hope so. I mean, it's the show that I've enjoyed the most of out of the list this year. It's very innovative. It has received some criticism, mainly from a kind of wider philosophical point about feminism and faithful book adaptations. But I think if you literally just take it as a TV show, it's gripping, it's smart, it's weirdly, horribly prescient of what's going on in the world today.
Completely depressing.
Oh, profoundly depressing. But I still found myself like mainlining like six episodes in a go.
Totally.
I think it's beautiful as well. It's really very beautiful to watch.
And what about Better Call Saul, which is a TV show that strikes me as really interesting because it seems to link up a real range of people who love that, from right. kind of like teens to kind of like quite older people seem to be addicted to it.
Mm.
And it was obviously a prequel as well. So how well do you think that will do?
I can't see it winning, if I'm honest. I mean, I really enjoyed the first series of Better Call Saul. I tailed off in the later ones. For those who don't know, it is a spin-off about the criminal lawyer in Breaking Bad, and I think it was originally conceived as a means to feed that beast who loved watching Walter White and go around his drug crime, and I just feel a bit exhausted by it now, but it's funny, it's gripping, it doesn't take much brain power to digest, I think, and a lot of people like that from TV.
Another one of the nominees for Best Drama is The Crown,
yeah.
which I also binged. I loved that.
I did enjoy The Crown. I liked The Crown.
I didn't think I'd enjoy such a good old American but it's getting into the monarchy so much.
But. Yeah, but it's also a quite successful history of the UK at that time. Yeah. That's, I think, that why it's one of the things that works on more levels. But it's so far had a bit of a disastrous time when it's gone up for other nominations here in the UK, for example. Do you think it will do better this time?
I think it will do better because it's an American judging panel. I think there's very much a feeling that The Crown is what the BBC would have made if it wasn't so steeped in British tradition and loyalty to the monarchy and had the ridiculous budgets that they had to make The Crown. I think actually the person who should really win out with The Crown is Claire Foy, who is brilliant. And this was really the making of her, this show.
I mean, a lot of people say the winner might be Stranger Things.
Yeah, I love Stranger Things.
I also enjoyed.
Yeah.
What do they have going for them?
Stranger Things is fascinating because it was a sleeper hit. So with Hulu and Amazon and Handmaid's Tale, that was very much like, trailered, look at our big show. Now, Stranger Things was kind of quietly one of those new original shows that Netflix are now making in their dozens every month. And last summer, you know, water cooler by water cooler around the world, everybody got obsessed with this weird, nerdy sci-fi phenomenon. And I just think it's a real triumph of the underdog.
It's like the Goonies. I mean, it's for people who were born in the 80s like me, it's like the Goonies.
Yeah, but I think also you touched on this, something that's, you know, again, despite all the algorithms and all the testing and all the market research, there's still something magic that happens between the finishing of a TV show and then it being aired. And it was, you know, in this office and with friends, the same thing. Everybody was talking about that show and you couldn't quite explain it. And I'm sure there's lots of other TV execs trying to work out how they can copy the formula. But, you know, in this world of algorithms and such market research, are you still surprised that you can have these quirky hits?
I'm not so much surprised as really so pleased that we can have these quirky hits. I mean, I think it just shows that TV consumers and TV viewers we can't be programmed by people sitting in meeting rooms. We still want creative, innovative TV, and that is just excellent, because can you imagine how boring it would be if all television was decided by what did well last time?
And also the Emmys, what do they really represent? Because The Wire never won an Emmy.
Right.
A 5-season run, which is completely baffling.
And I also think that House, you know,
one of the greatest shows of all time. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. And I think it was Mad Men, you know, they were consistently nominated. Jon Hamm struggled to ever get an award. You know, like, yes, they are strangely myopic in what they pick up. And I think they do tend to go for the big hitters. I'm so bored of House of Cards getting nominated, frankly. And I think those niche shows, or the ones that the media love to write about, but people don't necessarily love to watch in quite the same amount, will get overlooked.
We talked about the comparison with the Oscars earlier, and there it's clear what that dividend is. I mean, if you win an Oscar, if you're an actor or an actress, it's going to add to your salary. For these shows, which are series, is it more that they think we'll more likely be recommissioned now? Is that the big dividend of getting an Emmy?
It certainly doesn't hurt. But I think what it does do is it benefits the creatives. So, for example, with Transparent, which started out as an Amazon pilot, which is this kind of suck it and see Amazon process of letting the viewers decide what they want to watch before they make a whole show, last year really triumphed at the Emmys. And that was great for Jill Soloway, its creator, because she had put through this weird queer comedy drama about transgender people. And here it was getting a pat on the back. And I just think that's when the Emmys come into their own. Of course, you'll probably get recommissioned as well, which helps.
And also the weird thing is, just to throw in, Game of Thrones didn't,
yes.
Because it didn't qualify for the past season, right? It didn't air in
because
the last season.
It didn't
season,
air in the right time.
Which is a bit weird because it's the most talked about TV show and it's not being put up for best drama.
And you'll end up with this strange thing where it might get nominated next year while we're still waiting for the final series to come out, because no one actually knows when that's going to air yet.
Indeed.
By which point everyone will be like, what, dragons? I can't quite remember what happened.
Well, let's see what happens. But in the meantime, Alice, thank you very much for coming in to see us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Now, we're often told not to play with our food, but that doesn't mean we can't give it a good old poke here and there to see how it works.
Science broadcaster Marty Jobson has a more inquisitive mind than most on the matter, and his new book, The Science of Food, looks at just that, investigating the strange processes that go on behind preparing food, from the workings of pressure cookers to pasteurization. And Marty joins us on the line now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Well, Marty, I think Andrew and I are probably just going to barrage you for the next 10 minutes of questions we've had since we were little kids about food and how you make them. So first of all, the legend of the 5-second rule, is there any truth to this?
So this is something that I looked into for the book, actually. The 5-second rule is the idea that if you drop something on the food, it's safe to eat as long as it's been there for less than 5 seconds. It's sort of one of those old adages that people have. And no, it's not true at all. Of course, if you drop something on the floor, if there are bacteria on the floor, it will instantly pick up those bacteria. They will adhere to the whatever it is you've dropped on the floor to a certain extent. And then if you eat them, you are going to eat those bacteria. So the question, it actually slightly, unfortunately, comes down to a question about risk assessment, which might not sound hugely exciting. But the idea is that, do you know what's on your floor? It could be something really quite unpleasant that could make you very ill. I always like to equate it. I used to say to people who say, oh, you know, it'll be fine, just sort of give it a bit of a brush and eat it. I say, well, would you lick your floor? And if the answer to that is no, then then you probably shouldn't be eating food that has dropped on your floor, because that's essentially what you're doing. I mean, you will be transferring those bacteria straight into your mouth. It's about risk. It's about whether you are willing to take that risk in the end.
You also look at the notion that I think many of us think about when we get to the issue of taste, that if we have foods which are kind of like healthy and diet foods, and they tend to lose their flavour, and what we need is a little bit of fat in there to make something properly delicious. Is there any truth in the fact that we are kind of like programmed to need fat to really enjoy flavour?
Well, the idea is that we are programmed to want high energy food, because that's just our sort of our deep historical ancestry. We seek out carbohydrates and fat because they're full of energy, and that's what we want. So that's why we like fats. They do things to food we put in our mouth in so much as they give the food a very smooth, creamy mouthfeel, which we also like because we associate it with fats. So when you eat something that has got a lot of fat in it, you have this association in your head of it being sort of rich and unctuous, which is because it's got lots of fat in it. There is some evidence that we can actually detect fat on our tongues. Also, a lot of flavour molecules actually dissolve into fat. So some of that will be carried through into your mouth by the fat. Is fatty food better, more flavourful? Not necessarily. You can duplicate that unctuous mouthfeel with modified starches, carbohydrates. You can make something nice and creamy without adding fat. You can, if you're clever with your flavourings, you can make things really delicious and tasty without adding fat. So fat is not necessarily flavour. When chefs say this, I see it as being lazy cooking, actually. And that you can just as easily make something completely delicious without loads of fat involved.
Marty, what about artificial sweeteners? I mean, over the years, we've heard everything from, you know, that it causes cancer, to it makes you lose weight, to it makes you gain weight. Is it good or is it bad for you? Or is it still inconclusive?
The sort of the very bottom line in terms of, does it cause cancer? The vast majority of data on this says, no, it doesn't. You know, all the various artificial sweeteners, some of them like aspartame, is one of the most studied things that we eat. And the vast majority of the results show that it is not going to cause you any harm. Yes, it can make you lose weight in so much as it reduces your calorie intake. And, you know, from a sort of a thermodynamic point of view, from a sort of a physics point of view, ultimately, if you eat more calories than you expend during the day, you will put on weight. It's as simple as that. So if you eat less calories, you have a better chance of not putting on weight, possibly even losing weight. However, some work in rats suggests that if you eat lots of sweeteners, you actually put on weight, bizarrely, because it fools your body into thinking that it's eaten something, but it hasn't, and then it all goes a bit haywire, and you end up wanting to eat more because you're not satisfied. So the sort of the bit of your brain that tells your body that you've had enough food doesn't get shut off.
So you can maybe you could debunk a myth. Somebody in this office, when they ever saw me drinking a diet drink, said that will make you fat because it makes your body think it's had a sugar, and you could start going into a storage phase of storing energy, and it doesn't work as a diet drink. Is there any truth in that, or is that a load of old nonsense? Because I'd like to.
There is truth about that in rats.
Okay.
In some studies,
not editors,
but not all studies. So some rat studies have shown that this happens, what you've just described, and some haven't found it. So the jury's out, as it were, if you're a rat. But does that apply to humans? We just don't know. It's really difficult to do nutritional science on human beings because, you know, we all have this enormously varied genetic makeup, and that makes a difference. We do know that if you control the number of calories you eat, you will lose weight if you want to, or you will not put on weight. So I would say that that's probably not true, unless you're drinking like gallons and gallons of the stuff every day, and then you might want to worry about it.
And of course, Marty, it's not only just the chemistry of cooking that you talk about, but also, I mean, you write about kitchen gadgets as well, and you write about the physics of the knife and chopping board. Maybe you could enlighten us about that.
I've written a couple of books on sort of everyday science, and the way I sort of come up with the ideas of what to write is I just sort of hang out in, I go down to my kitchen and just sort of wander around and look at things and say, how does that work? And the obvious thing to look at is the knives, because it's the ultimate in kitchen utensils. You can do pretty much anything with a knife, chop, dice, mince, all sorts of things. So I started asking, you know, how do they work? And there's a surprising lot of science involved. I mean, the act of cutting with a knife, how does a cut actually start and then get propagated? And it's actually more to do with friction. If you don't have friction on the surface of your knife, on the tip of the knife, the knife blade has to have friction, because if there's no friction, then it can't overcome the bonds between the molecules in the thing that you're cutting. So a sharp knife blade is actually more like a serrated edge. A blunted knife blade is smooth and rounded. So, you know, when you sharpen your knife blade, you're actually putting these tiny little serrations onto the knife very microscopically. So there's all sorts of interesting science in there, and some new stuff as well. I mean, we've got ceramic blades. Have you come across these?
Oh, I have. I think I may even have one in my kitchen drawer.
Yeah, they're great. They're wonderful. But they're almost impossible to sharpen because they are so hard. Because to sharpen something, you need something harder than the thing you're sharpening. Otherwise, you can't sharpen it. It just doesn't work. Now, with steel, that's relatively straightforward. You just have a very hard steel and you use that. But with a ceramic blade, you've got to basically use something coated in diamonds to sharpen it. So sharpening a ceramic blade is nigh on financially unviable. And it's also very difficult because, you know, you have to apply lots of pressure and stuff. So actually they say, you know, with ceramic blades, you either send them away to be sharpened or you just throw them away. They suggest, actually, some manufacturers say, you know, if the blade is blunt, just get rid of it, buy a new one.
Marty, when you came to do this book, you're known here in the UK for your appearances on TV. You're very good at explaining these rather complicated ideas, as we've heard today, in a very popular way. What's your inspiration for the book? Is it hoping that people who are in their kitchens will think differently about the food that they're making that's on their plate? Or are you trying to connect more with a science audience for what you write?
So my audience is always, for everything I do, whether I'm on stage, in front of the camera, writing, is always about, I like to call them the people who don't know they're interested in science. That's really who I'm trying to write for and appeal to. You know, there are science fans out there, there are science geeks who will happily lap up all the stuff that you put out. And they're serviced by lots and lots of people and lots of outlets. But I like to talk to people and work with people and try to communicate with people who maybe don't realise how interested in science they are. So the books are written in as easiest way as possible for everyone to understand. So this is something that hopefully your gran could pick up, or your uncle that's never been interested in science, or your 14-year-old niece or whatever it is. All these people could pick up the book, read it, get something from it, hopefully. Some of it is, as you know, it's things like the 5-second rule, you know, dropping stuff on the floor. It's fairly straightforward. But then, you know, I like to really dig in as well to some more complicated things to do with the future of food and where it's all going and stuff like that. So it's not necessarily for a science audience, although obviously a science audience would hopefully very much enjoy it because there's a lot of detail here. But it's also for people who don't necessarily know that they are interested in science in the first place.
Well, Marty, thanks very much for that. That's The Science of Food, an Exploration of What We Eat and How We Cook, and it's out now. Thanks for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Well, that was quite nice, Danny, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had some food, we had some television, we learned how to pitch, we learned how we all are doing pitches every moment of our lives.
Stephen Bailey had a very nice suit on.
He did. Brilliant Savile Row, probably.
I like a man red. Who writes about in his book that it's presentation is all important, including how you arrive looking. And he lived up to his book's ideals.
He did indeed. A well-presented man who knows how to make a pitch. Andrew, I think that's it for this week.
Oh, no. Anyway, should we thank the crew? I'm going to thank our producer, Tom Hall, our researchers, Sophia Amadi, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin.
The Monocle Weekly is back again next week. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks very much.